So, as I've been writing this paper, I've been talking with a lot of people about witchcraft. And I found that although many people are attracted to the idea of witchcraft, they have very different concepts of what it's about. Sometimes I wonder about my own fascination with witchcraft, and I think in part it's due to the fact that I often have feelings of powerlessness, and therefore I'm very much attracted to power. At any rate, most of the people I talked with were attracted to witchcraft for different reasons, and were not familiar with my ideas about witchcraft. So I think I will tell you first how I'm not going to be talking about witchcraft. I'm not going to be talking about it as voodoo, or Satanism, or what's called black magic, or as a kind of devil worship. Nor am I going to be talking about witchcraft from a psychological viewpoint, as if witchcraft only existed in the imagination. There are several ways of looking at witchcraft. One way is believing that a devil does exist, and that witches do exist, and witchcraft is the work of the devil. Another way is to say that witches do not exist, except in the imagination, although a personal devil does exist. Still another approach is to say that neither a devil nor witches exist, except in the imagination, or among primitive peoples who are trying to make some sense out of the universe. This last approach seems to be favored in the culture we live in. I think we have a tendency not to believe something exists if we can't explain it, or if we can explain it, then we tend to explain it away or to make it safe. Yeah. Tape recorder with the music.
What's happened?
Maybe it's coming out of the walls or something. Is that what? It's witchcraft, right? Am I speaking too quickly or something?
No.
It's bugging you. Okay, I'll try. Hang on a second. Where was I? Okay, we're talking about primitive people. So in this culture, you get the idea that primitive peoples who are not supposed to have any concept in their language for which there does not exist a corresponding physical reality, you have primitive peoples believing in witchcraft as a force behind some unexplainable phenomena. Now, I'm not out either to prove or refute this way of thinking, and I'm sure there's some basis of truth to it, but I'd like to keep the question open as to what witchcraft is, because I'm going to be talking about witchcraft in a whole other perspective. Witchcraft has a very long history. I think I should point out here that I'm talking about European witchcraft and not African witchcraft. I have very little knowledge of the history of African witchcraft, and I feel that my roots lie more in European witchcraft. So first, it is a history that we are familiar with, which is the burning of the witches in Europe in the Middle Ages. But it is also a history that goes before the burning, even before the advent of Christianity. In fact, there is a continuity of culture that produced the witches who were burned in medieval Europe. Witches are not just historical freaks. They did not pop up in time about the 13th century. They have their roots in a very old culture. And this culture was very probably a matriarchy, or at least it was a culture where female powers were highly valued. This female culture also did not just pop up in time and then wither away. Female culture continued in various places, in various forms and systems throughout the ancient world and well into the Middle Ages. So the way I am talking about witchcraft is as a whole other culture, which is very different from this culture we live in. Witchcraft, as a culture, had its own values, origins, relationship to the world, and its own way of doing things. It also put an emphasis on women using their own powers, and it valued these powers. Now, I find this quite amazing because our culture, with its roots in Christianity and its long tradition of misogyny, existed side by side with the witch culture in Europe for centuries. It fascinates me to imagine that our culture today, with its European origins, might have been very different if the witches had not been almost all wiped out. The history of witchcraft in medieval Europe is actually a history of the witch trials. That is, it's a history of the Inquisition of the Church. So when we read the witch trials, we are only getting one side of the story. Now, it's curious that the image we have of a witch from ancient times through the Middle Ages, even to today, is that of a woman. There's the Greek or Roman prophetess, then the medieval picture of the witch as either a sensuous young woman or an evil stepmother, and now there's the Disneyland cartoon of the wicked and warty old hag. But despite the changing image, one thing is clear, they're all women. Men did practice witchcraft and were persecuted for it, but the majority of its practitioners and victims were women. Even the medieval inquisitors wondered why so many more women than men were witches. A book called the Malleus Maleficarum, roughly translated as Hammer to Hit Witches With, came out in about 1484 AD, at the time when the church was beginning to come down heavy on witchcraft. The authors, Heinrich Kramer and James Springer, who were professors of sacred theology at the University of Cologne, asked this question, quote, "Why is it that women are chiefly addicted to evil superstitions?" Which means, why are there more women than men who are witches? The authors of the Malleus answer this question in a very long, involved argument with many biblical examples and quotations from ancient misogynists. Essentially, the reasons are these. One, women are wicked. The examples used here are, quote, "All wickedness is but little to the wickedness of a woman." And this following quotation from St. John Chrysostom, which is a trip. Quote, "What else is woman but a foe to friendship, an unescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a natural temptation, a desirable calamity, a domestic danger, a delectable detriment, an evil of nature painted with fair colors." There's more. The second reason that more women than men are witches is, quote, "that women are naturally more impressionable, and that means that they're more easily taken in by the devil." The third reason is that they have, quote, "slippery tongues," and are unable to conceal from their fellow women those things which by evil arts they know. And since they are weak, they find an easy and secret manner of vindicating themselves by witchcraft. This last reason is actually quite perceptive. Probably many women in the Middle Ages who were not witches and who were kept in a powerless social position tried out witchcraft as a means of obtaining some sort of power. But other than her, quote, weak memory, and the fact that, quote, women are intellectually like children, and that she is, quote, a liar by nature, the Malleus goes on to say that, quote, the natural reason is that she is more carnal than man, as is clear from her many carnal abominations. The Malleus concludes this argument with, quote, all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which in women is insatiable. Therefore, for the sake of fulfilling their lusts, they consort even with devils. Now I ask you, if the church's attitude toward women was so insensitive and even downright nasty, can you believe their descriptions of witches? Because the same sort of hostile language is used to describe both women and witches. It occurred to me that the attack on witchcraft might be just a cover-up for a deeper hostility against women, but I don't think that's the whole case. Because if we look into the witch trials and try to disregard the bias of the inquisitors, there emerges a different sort of picture of who witches really were. Witchcraft, as it was persecuted in medieval Europe, was a religion. And it was a religion that was a way of life, that is, it was a culture. This is actually not a new idea. The late Dr. Margaret Murray, who wrote two very fine books on witchcraft, proposed the theory that medieval witchcraft was actually a fertility cult. The witches did not worship a devil, they worshiped a god. This god was a horned god, often portrayed in the shape of a goat. Dr. Murray also proposes that the cult originated with nomadic tribes whose way of life was breeding and living off flocks of goats and sheep. The reason for our idea of witches worshiping a devil is in the bias of the church, which was transmitted through the records of the trials. The inquisitors, who were good Christians, just could not conceive of another god inhabiting the universe. The witches could not be worshiping God because only the Christians worship the true God. Therefore, the witches must be worshiping a devil. Now, as the devil exists in Christian mythology as Satan, this must have been the devil that the witches were worshiping. So, during the centuries of witch trials, the Christian devil came to look like the horned god of the witches. The witches, however, did not regard their god as a devil or as an embodiment of evil. He was very much a god. This attitude comes out very clear in the witch trials. There's a story of a Madame Bourignon, a good Christian, who founded a home for poor girls in Lille, in France. One day in the year 1661, one of the girls told Madame Bourignon that, quote, her mother had taken her with her when she was very young and had even carried her in her arms to the witch's sabbat. Well, Madame Bourignon was shocked, and then she was even more upset to find that the other girls had attended the sabbat and that, in fact, her home for poor girls was a hotbed of witches. Madame Bourignon reports that the girls, quote, declared that they had daily carnal cohabitation with the devil, that they went to the sabbats or meetings where they ate, drank, danced, and committed other whoredom and sensualities. And you can be sure this is Madame Bourignon's side of the story. She continues, quote, they had not the least design of changing, to quit these abominable pleasures. As one of them, of 22 years old, one day told me, no, said she, I will not be other than I am. I find too much content in my condition. I am always caressed. Now, this story is important in several respects. First, that the witches enjoyed their form of worship and were quite content to keep it. This is also borne out by the opinions of many other witches who were brought to trial. Second, if you can read between the lines of Madame Bourignon's report, there is a very good description of what witches really did at their Sabbats. Third, the girls were poor and rather innocent about declaring that they were witches. This might imply that witchcraft or the cult of the witches existed mostly among the poorer classes where it was more readily accepted. The girls could certainly not have been of a very Christian state of mind, for they would have felt guilty about consorting with witches and devils, and would have been aware of the consequences of talking about it. Surely this means that Europe was really not as Christianized as the church would have us believe. That is, that the witch cult was the real religion of the masses. Also, the girls questioned do not seem to have any inhibitions about talking of their sexual activities. Now, sexuality for Christians in this time would have been at best a necessary evil, and hence use of the words like whoredom and sensualities and abominations. But if the witches belonged to a fertility cult, then sexuality would of course be part of the ritual and would have been accepted as such and maybe even considered sacred. The festivals, or Sabbats, appear to have been sort of community picnics. They were always held at a certain fixed place on certain dates, and there were four major festivals, one on May Eve, which is April 30th, Lammas, which is August 1st, All Hallows Eve, which is October 31st, and Candlemas, which is February 2nd. Following Dr. Murray's fertility cult theory, these dates correspond with the breeding seasons of flocks and herds of goats, and they don't correspond with agricultural seasons. So it becomes more clear that the cult of the witches probably originated with some sort of nomadic tribe. In addition to the Sabbats, there were smaller festivals called Espats. These were held at midsummer and midwinter. There was also a sort of Easter festival. These could have been a later addition to the fertility cult by people who practiced some sort of sun worship, and perhaps the pre-Celtic people. The witch cult, like any other religion, incorporated practices from religions of other cultures. The fertility cult, or the old religion, as witchcraft was called by the people who practiced it, probably to distinguish it from the new religion, which was Christianity. Witchcraft was a very practical religion. It said, essentially, that paradise was here on earth. Considering this, it makes sense that the witches who were brought to trial did not want to change their religion. For who would give up a religion that promised paradise here and now for a new religion which preached poverty, humility, denial of pleasure, enjoyment of suffering, plus the tenuous offer of paradise in an afterlife if you were very, very good as well? The god of the witches always appeared at the Sabbath, but the Christian god never made an appearance. So although the rituals or the Sabbaths centered on community involvement, there are also certain men and women who could be called priests or priestesses who had a deeper understanding of the subtleties of the religion. These people were banded together in small groups of 12 plus the horned god to make 13. The groups were called covens, and their members were the ones whom the general community went to for help. That the Sabbaths were general meetings as well as festivals, as was pointed out by the Inquisitor de Lancre, indicates a strong community involvement of the witches. The witch cult was actually a way of life. The Sabbaths were also a festival eating and drinking and dancing and making love, sort of like a picnic. The witch Helen Guthrie in 1661 says at her trial that at one Sabbath, quote, they all danced together a while and then went to Mary Ryan's house and sat down together at the table and made themselves merry. And the devil made much of them all, but especially of Mary Rind, and he kissed them all. Marie Lamont in 1662 says at her trial that the devil, quote, sung to them and they danced, and he gave them wine to eat and wheat bread to eat, and they were all very merry. In 1679, Annabel Thompson, Bessie Vicker, and Margaret Hamilton were tried in Scotland and accused of consorting with the devil. Once in Bessie's house in the night when, quote, the devil brought the ale extending to about 7 gallons. Once when the devil invited Annabel to, quote, go alongst and drink with him, and several times in Margaret's house when the devil shared, quote, several choppins of ale. Now this sort of thing seems really all very innocent if it weren't for this mysterious person called the devil. The devil, or so he was recorded by the inquisitors, seems to have been not the embodiment of evil walking about the countryside as the Christians thought he was, but an actual person within the witch religion who acted the part of the horned god. He is identified by several witches as being a dark man, often riding a dark horse or carrying a staff. He wore cloven shoes, which was a style in the Middle Ages, with a cleft toe, presumably so he could be identified as the horned god. He seems to have been a well-respected member of the witch community. It's probable that he was acting as a representative of the horned god, or that the witches actually considered him to be the god, so that he was the embodiment of the horned god on this earth. At the Sabbath, the witches described him as, quote, big and black. He felt cold to the touch, and he spoke with a, quote, hollow, shrill voice. Now, it's likely, pursuing the fertility cult theory, that the devil, or the man who was representing the devil, who was the horned god, was probably dressed in skins, which would make him feel cold, and look big and black. And he probably also wore a mask, which would make his voice sound odd. As for the quoted copulation with the devil, which would be part of a fertility rite, the devil probably used an artificial phallus. For, as the witch Isabel Gowdy said in 1662, quote, his members are exceeding great and long. No man's members are so long and big as they are. So, some women probably suffered pain in this fertility ritual, but it seems that it had more of a symbolic significance than a pleasurable one. The significance was probably the promotion of fertility. And all this really points to a very innocent and pagan fertility cult which practiced a primitive sort of sympathetic magic. And if you look in the witches and look at the witches in this light, it's difficult to understand why the church was so upset with them. But there are other practices of the witches that show that these people had a great deal of power. The Christian religion had co-opted several pagan beliefs so as to undercut the effect of the pagan religion on the natives. But there is obviously some other reason than pagan worship for the church's persecution of the witches, because the persecution by the church really shows a tremendous belief in the powers of the witches. The word witch comes from an old Anglo-Saxon word, wicca, which means wise. Witchcraft is then the craft of the wise. The Saxons did not practice witchcraft, but they do seem to have had a healthy respect for it because they called the people who practiced it wise. They didn't condone it. And when the Saxons became Christianized, they began to pass laws against the craft. I think this is where the word lost its first meaning of wise, and that the first evil connotations began with the word witch. It's interesting to note that another word derived from Wicca is wicked. Hence you have the wicked witch. Witches were accused time and time again of using superhuman knowledge and power to do evil, or ironically enough, to do good. I'd like to make a distinction here between ritual witchcraft and operative witchcraft. Ritual witchcraft is what I've been talking about, which is the rites practiced by those people who were called witches by the church. Operative witchcraft, by its name, indicates a knowledge of magic or a knowledge of the use of superhuman powers. Operative witchcraft is common to all primitive peoples and even to not so primitive peoples, in that it denotes a knowledge of spells, incantations, charms, etc., which are said to cause some unrelated event to happen. The reason I say it is practiced by not so primitive peoples is that prayers can be considered a form of operative witchcraft, and talismans or fetishes or relics, all of which abound in the Christian church. Also such things as what is called sympathetic magic, such as copulation with a horned god, or eating a wafer and calling it the body and blood of Christ, these things all come under the term operative witchcraft. Some forms are more useful than others. Ritual witchcraft, then, or the cult of the witches, included the knowledge and practice of certain forms of operative witchcraft. And these practices seem to have been very efficient, judging anyway by the accusations brought against witches or the zealousness with which they were persecuted. Some of the operative witchcraft that medieval witches were accused of were consorting with the devil, flying to the Sabbat, preventing procreation in people and animals, depriving men of their penises, changing men into beasts, visiting men in the shape of spirits in order to entice them sexually, inflicting illness in people and animals, causing abortion in women, healing people, raising up storms, causing people to be struck with lightning, killing off people with wax images, divining by various methods, and eating children. Now, I don't think that all these accusations can be put down to medieval paranoia. I think there is a basis of truth to all of them. Things like eating children is probably just bad press, because the Christians also accused the Jews of eating children, and it seems to be a common thing to accuse people you don't like of eating children. As for consorting with the devil, that appears to be part of the sympathetic magic of the fertility cult, and it was certainly not the Christian devil that the witches were consorting with, but a representative of their own god. There are several theories about the witches flying to the Sabbat. One is that the witches were deluded. Another is that they were using astral projection. And still another is that they were using drugs. Now, this last theory seems to hold up quite well, in that it's known that the witches smeared an ointment over themselves before they went off to the Sabbat. And there are three recipes for this ointment which have survived, and all of them contain some sort of drug which is conducive to hallucinations. In all the recipes, there is aconite, deadly nightshade, which is belladonna, or hemlock. All of these can be poisonous if taken in large amounts, so the witches surely must have had an extensive knowledge of poisons. But in the right amounts, these drugs produce certain physical effects. Aconite and hemlock produce a slowing of the heart or an irregular heartbeat. Hemlock also produces delirium. And the sensation of flying in dreams is said to be due to an irregular heartbeat. So that is the effect the drugs probably produce. The witches really felt they were flying to the Sabbat. Belladonna is said to produce a state similar to LSD. The ointment, when rubbed on in broken skin, is harmless, but it can be absorbed by the quicks of the nails or by any broken skin. At this point, it's interesting to recall the three books of Carlos Castaneda, whose teacher, Don Juan, was a Yaqui Indian witch who made use of psilocybin and other hallucinogenic drugs to achieve an altered state of consciousness in order to obtain knowledge to use in witchcraft. So witchcraft, then, is not really a simple fertility cult, but a culture that had use of knowledge acquired through hallucinogenic drugs. And that sort of culture seems to me very highly advanced. The prevention of procreation, as ascribed to witches, could be due to psychic influence, or it could be paranoia of the Christian people, as their sexuality was very highly repressed. It's interesting to note that in the Malleus, the authors make a distinction between witches stopping the generative act or preventing women from conceiving and Christians doing the same thing. Quote, "Without the help of devils, a man can, by natural means, such as herbs, savin, for example, or other emmenagogues, procure the woman cannot generate or conceive." So evidently, birth control was practiced and accepted by medieval Christians. Witches, though, did different sort of things, such as taking off a man's penis. This accusation is seriously brought up in the Malleus. Quote, "Here is declared the truth about the diabolic operations with regard to the male organ. And to make plain the facts in this matter, it is asked whether witches can, with the help of devils, really and actually remove the member, or whether they only do so apparently by some glamour or illusion. I'm sure that all the Christians must have suffered incredibly from a castration complex. And probably if any woman who was suspected of being a witch said anything nasty to a man, he immediately presumed himself to be castrated. So we can see that being called a castrating bitch is evidently not a new experience. The same sort of fantasy could be ascribed to the accusation of sexual enticement, where women appeared to men as spirits. As for inflicting illness or curing illness and procuring abortion, it's already been shown that the witches had a great knowledge of poisonous herbs, and it's probable that they had a knowledge of medicinal herbs and were able to use them appropriately and efficiently. The Malleus bitterly attacks, quote, women who are midwives, who in various ways kill the child conceived in the womb and procure an abortion, or if they do not this, offer newborn children to devils. The Malleus goes on to say that, quote, since the devils do these things through the medium of women and not men, this form of homicide is associated rather with women than men. Now, there's actually a lot of information here. The practitioners of the witch cult were skilled midwives who were also adept at abortion. This medical skill lay primarily in the hands of women. It is difficult to say whether the women who were witches were more skilled in medical practices, or whether it was a female occupation in the culture of the witches to be a midwife. At any rate, it certainly seems to say that women's powers were valued. As for offering the children to the devils, if the god of the witches was a fertility god, it is very natural that he would be thanked when the child was born. But the Malleus considers midwives to be the worst sort of criminals in witchcraft, saying, quote, no one does more harm to the Catholic faith than midwives. The witches were able to control the biology of women. It must have been very threatening to the church. It's said that in a matriarchy, the woman is valued because she conceives life. And mythologically, she is also considered to have control over death. The church was not too keen on women having this sort of control, or any other control for that matter. And the witch midwives must have made the church very nervous. The other practices of the witches are difficult to explain. The divining by various means, raising storms, inflicting death by images, which is similar to voodoo, and healing over distances appear to belong to the realm of psychic phenomena. I don't think they were fantasies, for they come up again and again and are told with a very startling reality. For example, in the Malleus, there's this story. I'm going to quote the whole story because I think it's really fascinating. Quote, in Swabia, a certain farmer went to his field with his little daughter, hardly 8 years old, to look at his crops, and began complaining about the drought, saying, alas, when will it rain? The girl heard him, and in the simplicity of her heart said, father, if you want it to rain, I can soon make it come. And her father said to her, what, do you know how to make it rain? And the girl answered, I can make it rain, and I can make hailstorms and tempests too. And the father asked, who taught you? She answered, My mother, but she told me never to tell anybody. Then her father asked, how did she teach you? And she answered, she sent me to a master who will do anything I ask at any time. But her father said, have you seen him? And she said, I have sometimes seen men coming in and out to my mother. And when I asked her who they were, she told me they were our masters to whom she had given me, and that they were powerful and rich patrons. The father was terrified and asked her if she could raise a hailstorm then. And the girl said, yes, if I had a little water. Then he led the girl by the hand to the stream and said, do it, but only on our land. And the girl put her hand in the water and stirred it in the name of her master, as her mother had taught her, and behold, the rain fell only on that land. Seeing this, the father said, make it hail now, but only on one of our fields. And when the girl had done this, the father was convinced by the evidence and accused his wife before the judge. And the wife was taken and convicted and burned, but the daughter was reconciled and solemnly dedicated to God, since which hour she could no more work these spells and charms. Now, if this story is true, then the knowledge that was known to both the mother and the daughter is now lost. If you don't believe in this sort of operative witchcraft, then think of the rain dances of the North American Indians and how people are surprised that they so often work. The culture of the witches was very like the culture of the North American Indians. It was attuned to nature, to being in harmony with the universe, and was generally a cooperative society rather than a competitive one. It also placed a high value on female powers, and its practitioners were able to accomplish some very interesting phenomena that could be called magic, which is certainly not understood by our culture. It seems that we are more culturally better related to the man who got his wife convicted than to the woman and her daughter. And I think this is in some ways a shame. This story in the Malleus is interesting in another way because it appears that the religion was passed from mother to daughter, and that it was part of ritual witchcraft for women to have access or opportunity to learn the secret knowledge of the operative witchcraft. So far, I've been talking about witchcraft only as the cult of the horned god, but there is evidence that this cult comes from an older cult which is based on goddess worship. The goddess is Diana, who was the Roman goddess of the hunt. The older cult is called the Dianic cult. There is a church canon from about the 9th century AD, which is attributed to a council which was held in Ancyra in AD 314, which says in part, quote, that certain wicked women, disciples of Satan, seduced by the illusions and devices of the devil, believe and confess that they ride through the air on certain beasts at night in company with Diana, the pagan goddess, or Herodias, and with a host of other women, obeying the goddess's orders as if she was their absolute mistress. Herodias is probably a corruption of the name Aradia, and Aradia is the daughter of Diana. Charles Leland, who was a 19th century folklore enthusiast, obtained from an Italian witch a Gospel of the Witches, and it was published in about 1899. It goes briefly as follows. that Tanna, or Diana, who is queen of witches all, was the goddess of the witches. Tanna, the moon, fell in love with Lucifer, the sun, who was turned out of paradise for his pride. As a result of this union of brother and sister, a daughter, Aradia, or Herodias, was born, who was the female messiah of the witch cult. Diana told her daughter that, although she was a spirit, she was born only to become a mortal and to go down to earth to teach witchcraft to humanity. The witches, of whom Diana was to be the first in chief, were to be taught the secret of magic power and such arts as poisoning and crop blasting in order that they might free the downtrodden from their oppressors. This gospel of the witches from the late 19th century is a curious mixture of goddess worship and biblical reference, sun and moon worship, and medieval witch powers. Some of it is reminiscent of the Demeter Persephone myth, and it also has a little bit of revolutionary spirit thrown in. Diana is portrayed as moon goddess, mother goddess, lover of the horn god or the sun god, instigator of an incestuous union, which is an ancient Egyptian practice, and chief of the witches. From this gospel, it appears that witchcraft was not just a pagan fertility cult, which existed in medieval Europe, but it was an amalgamation of several different ancient cultures. And I think that the question here is, what are the roots of witchcraft? But before that, perhaps we should look at ancient history in a whole different light. Elizabeth Gould Davis, in her book called The First Sex, makes a very good case for the existence of a female-dominated culture which spread throughout Europe several thousand years ago. About 9,000 years ago, a civilization flourished in what is now modern Turkey. Archaeologists have begun excavations in the last decade at three ancient cities in that area, and the earliest carbon dating puts the levels at about 7,000 BC. An amazing thing about this city, according to one archaeologist, is that the civilization was obviously dominated by women. The god of the civilization was a goddess, and the people buried in the most splendid tombs were women. In addition, the archaeologists found that there had been thousand-year periods of peace, no evidence of wars or violent deaths, that the society had been ordered, that it was vegetarian, and that there were no human or animal sacrifices. Now, this pleasant sort of civilization bears out the theories of what a matriarchy was supposed to be. According to theories, speculation about matriarchy, it would have been a civilization which put an emphasis on nurturance, on life, on the creative principle, and peace and friendly relations among people. Now, I'm not suggesting that a matriarchy actually existed. I'm only suggesting that evidence points to the fact that there was some sort of female culture, or a culture where women were highly valued, flourishing around the Mediterranean basin as early as 9,000 years ago. The artifacts found there are obviously connected to all sorts of other civilizations throughout Europe and Asia. The Anatolian civilization, which is the one I'm talking about, was not the vestige of an early and primitive childhood of mankind, but was probably the beginning of our civilization. As Davis says in The First Sex, quote, an important revelation at Catalhoeuc, which is the city which was being excavated, was the abundance of bull's horns found in the goddess's shrines and their resemblance to the horns of consecration of Crete and the later Aegean. Of equally great significance is the fact that the labyris, the sacred double axe of Crete, symbol of the goddess and of matriarchal rule, is found painted on the temple walls of Catalhoeuc. The double axe was a symbol of gynocratic power in Crete, as it was among the Lycians, Lydians, the Amazons, the Etruscans, and even the Romans. It has been found in the graves of Paleolithic women of Europe buried 50,000 years ago, and it appears carved in the sacred stones of pre-Celtic Stonehenge in England. In the Mycenaean Minoan civilization, which was believed to be Atlantis and which fell about 1000 BC, there is very certain evidence of the cult of the bull. The wall paintings showed the sport of bull leaping, which was done by both men and women. And it's interesting to note in Crete that the figures of women dominate the wall paintings, a fact which I think suggests of some sort of female culture in that civilization. That the double-headed axe is found on the stones of Stonehenge seems to indicate the existence of an early female culture also in Britain. Carbon dating of the first circle of Stonehenge puts the earliest date at about 2000 BC. The pre-Celtic people who built Stonehenge probably practiced a cult of sun and moon worship, as Stonehenge is believed to be a very accurate solar lunar computer. In the witch's gospel, Diana, who was chief of the witches and also moon goddess, falls in love with Lucifer, who is the Christian devil but can also be identified with the sun god. Perhaps the witch cult of medieval Europe incorporated into its worship the idea of a moon goddess and sun god from the pre-Celtic people. But the moon goddess, who is symbolized by the horns of the bull, like the horns look like the crescent moon, was also worshipped in Egypt. So it's difficult to tell just where the various elements of the witch cult were drawn from. But it's likely from the similar religious symbols that goddess worship or some sort of female culture was spread throughout the ancient world. And I'm not just talking about female culture, but I'm also talking about the roots of witchcraft. I believe that the earliest recording of a woman who was a witch is found in the Odyssey, which Homer is said to have conceived about the 8th century BC. Circe was that powerful witch who turned men into beasts. And changing men into beasts was one of the crimes witches were accused of in medieval Europe. So the practice is probably not a new one. Further on the connection of witchcraft and female culture, from about the 8th century BC to 376 AD, a cult flourished in the classical world that is now called the Eleusinian Mysteries. Now, what these mysteries actually were will probably remain a mystery, but there's evidence that they were based on the Demeter Persephone myth. Demeter was an earth goddess whose daughter Persephone was carried away by Pluto, who was god of the underworld. By his trickery, that is by getting her to eat six seeds of a pomegranate, Persephone was bound to visit him for 6 months of the year. The other six she could spend with her mother. So that explains the seasons, in that when Persephone is with Demeter, the mother goddess makes the earth blossom, and when Persephone is away, Demeter is sad and the earth is barren. These rites might have been some sort of psychological reconciliation with mother and daughter, and also some sort of sympathetic magic to make the crops grow. But very certainly it was a religion whose rites included the inducement of frenzy or ecstasy, which was very much like what the witches reported they felt at their Sabbat in the Middle Ages. Over the years, the Eleusinian mysteries got mixed up with the Dionysian mysteries. Dionysius was the god of wine, mirth, and frenzy. He appears to have taken over the mother-daughter mysteries. Dionysius is often portrayed as Pan, or the goat god, so the god of the witches of the Middle Ages seems to have a longer tradition than just a fertility cult of nomadic tribes who kept goats. As well, the horn god seems to have his roots in the Dionysian mysteries, whereas the Dianic cult of the witches had its roots in the older Eleusinian mother-daughter mysteries. It's interesting to see over the centuries the influence and later the dominance of the gods over the goddesses, like Dionysius over the great mother goddess. Now, the great mother goddess goes back to very ancient times, farther back than the name Demeter. She is Isis of the Egyptians, Astarte, Ashtoreth, Ishtar. Isis is said to have had 10,000 names. She changed from earth goddess to moon goddess at some historical point of time. And as moon goddess, she was said to have three faces, Diana, Demeter, and Hecate. The triple-faced goddess can also be found in African myth as the goddess Nagame, who is also a moon goddess. So the moon goddess is obviously very old and much older than the gods. It's amazing the number of goddesses in ancient times who underwent a sort of enforced sex change. Even Diana became Dianus, which is a masculine form, who in turn became Janus, which is a very early Roman god who has two faces. But Diana seems to have been too common to too many different cultures to have been erased completely. And her different functions in different cultures kept her alive and flourishing. As the great mother, the goddess of the underworld, as virgin goddess, as moon goddess, as goddess of the hunt, she survived in different combinations, in different places, and she stood for all the possible powers available to women. And it leads one to say, as Lethbridge did in his book on witches, that, quote, it appears that this Diana figure must have been goddess of everything, of life and death, peace and war, fertility and dearth. Men worshipped her in the particular guise which happened to appeal to them. So Diana, in her various aspects, was connected very early with witchcraft in different locations in the ancient world. The Celts, or the Cymri, as they called themselves, who were spread throughout Western Europe, invaded Britain about the 5th century BC. They seem to have gotten along well with the pre-Celtic people who built Stonehenge, and one can suppose that they were both of the same sort of culture, that is, a female culture. The Celts might have been a sort of second wave of this culture. The religion of the Celts was Druidism, and Druids were the forerunners of the witches. There is a passage in the Bardic Triads, which is a history of the Celtic people, which says, essentially, quote, there are three special doctrines that have been obtained by the nation of the Cymri. The first, from the age of ages, was that of the Gwythoniaid. The second was Bardism. The third was faith in Christ. Now the word withoniate can be translated as wizards or scientists, and withon can be translated as witch. So witchcraft evidently existed in Britain with and presumably before the Celts. More examples of the continuity of the culture. Strabo says in the first century AD, quote, in an island close to Britain, Demeter and Persephone are venerated with rites similar to the orgies of Samothrace. And the author Dionysius says in the fourth century AD that in the islands near Jersey and Guernsey, the rites of Bacchus, or Dionysius, were performed by the women crowned with leaves. They danced and made an even greater shouting than the Thracians. Now Apuleius says the Thrace was the original home of witchcraft or woman wisdom. So the Bacchic rites or the Dionysian mysteries or even the older Eleusinian mystery cult was spread all over Europe from the Mediterranean to Britain well after the advent of Christianity. So how did it happen that Christianity, with its traditional dislike of women, take hold in a world which was so valued female powers and which practiced certain forms of witchcraft? It's important to remember here that Christianity was a Jewish sect, and the Jews had long been excising from their own history any mention of their matriarchal background. The Hebrew tribes had originally worshipped a goddess, and traces of this worship can be found in the Old Testament. But the tribes, for some reason, imposed the god Yahweh, who is a male image, on the great mother figure. The Jews have a prayer in which the men daily thank their god that they were not born a woman. And out of this tradition came Christianity. I'd like to digress for a moment because there's an interesting astrological coincidence. As Davis says in the first sex, it's a curious fact that according to astrology, the age of the bull, the Taurian age, coincided historically with the last 2,000 years of the matriarchies, while the Aryan age, which is the age of Aries the ram, coincided with the age that immediately preceded the Christian era. The Piscean age, the age of the fish, embraced the Christian era, the 2,000-year period from which we are now just emerging. It's interesting that the fish was actually the secret symbol of Christianity and the cross was not. Also, it's interesting here to note the similarity between the astrological symbol of Aries the ram and the horned god of the witches. But back to Christianity, it's quite clear that the Christian church in its organization did not have all that much to do with the teachings of Christ.